Greeting, everybody. This is Jim Breeling. Welcome to our research call-in session for July 14th. We are honored and very privileged to have Bill Thiessen, professor of psychology at Wake Forest, as our guest presenter this evening. As a number of our listeners are very diligent advanced researchers, not only looking through the slides that go out with the reminder announcement, but looking up his CV and some of his papers and sending questions in. And I want to encourage people to do that. If you look at it in advance and can send your questions or comments in early, we can share it with the presenter and make the most of limited time in addressing your concerns. We also hope to have 2 to 3 listeners who do that advanced preparation join us for the question and answer as kind of a panel discussion. And I think we'll be really getting into gear with that with our August 4th session with Patrick Kennedy on mental health parity. So keep that in mind. If you do a little advanced preparation, you may have the opportunity to aid verbally with the former Congressman Patrick Kennedy. Bill Thiessen went through the academic career, a BA, MA, and PhD, and then had a very interesting development. He had a 4-year postdoc at the Max Planck Institute for Human Development in Berlin, 1996, which began just as the wall separating West and East Berlin came down, a very interesting time. And he's continued in doing interesting things. One of his interesting things that people commented on was that he is a co-investigator, co-director of a $3,600,000 grant from Templeton Foundation looking at moral character development. And this grant supports research at Wake Forest, but also the directors at Wake Forest are grant funders. They have, with money from this large grant, 12 junior investigators in the area. And it's kind of a model, I think, that for borderline, that if we can get a large funding both to support original research at a site, but also to nourish and help junior investigators start in research careers around the country. He has been very active in his profession, and one of the things is president of the Association for Research and Personality, which I think, as you, many people know, to be elected a president of these associations is really a recognition of your academic accomplishments and acumen. So it's a real tribute that we should have him as our speaker in view of the high esteem of which other researchers in the field hold him. He also is very innovative as a researcher. He won the 2002 Innovation Prize from the Society for Personality and Social Psychology for a theoretical innovations effort. And he has been very active in not only his publishing extensively, but as an associate editor and editor for multiple journals. In addition to development, personality, he also has statistical evidence and expertise as testified by people paying him to consult about statistical issues. And he also, when NIMH over a decade ago started to tighten up on basic behavioral research, you had to have relevance, clear and salient relevance to mental health research. Geraldine Downey was a leader, and Bill Thiessen followed in this path of making that transition from personality to psychopathology, and he's really embraced it quite well. His current grant that he's going to give us a overview of and a little teaser preview of interesting results tonight from it is almost $600,000 effort, as some of you know from the slides, or you will see, is rather large and interesting effort, and people are really jumping up and down to see the results of this. He's not only done this for the money and the data, But one of the courses he's come to teach at Wake Forest University is on borderline personality disorder. So he's really, really taken this seriously and well. He's got a lot to present, and let's talk about that and turn it over to Dr. Fleason.
Well, thank you, Dr. Brilliant. Your introductions are always so generous and so enthusiastic. You don't see how anybody can fail to be fired up after your introduction, so thank you very much. And also thanks to you and to everyone who's invited me here and all of you who are here listening. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this work. I also want to thank the National Education Alliance for the work that you're doing. I think this is really important work that you're doing. I really think it's great that you're doing it. So I'm going to talk today about the experience of borderline personality disorder. If you go to the first slide, I'm just going to read the abstract of the grant, which is that borderline personality disorder is a serious mental illness associated with severe personal distress, suicidality, interpersonal instability, and significant costs. Our research in this grant is tailored to address several significant problems in the understanding of this destructive disorder. By advancing understanding of the psychosocial factors that trigger its symptoms, we hope to improve diagnosis and treatment in a way that helps alleviate the personal and societal costs associated with borderline personality disorder. I want to point out the other people involved in this project before I start. So the key personnel that you could say they're the authors of this presentation are myself and Mike Furr, Elizabeth Arnold, Mary Kate Law, Michelle Anderson. We have many students and staff working on this project. And it's also supported by NIMH. And Dr. Billing, thanks to him, he was the one who ushered this project through. So this project is not like a typical research project that someone might see about borderline personality disorder. It has some unique features, and one of them is that it takes something that is usually thought of only as a between-person construct and studying it as a within-person construct. So, for example, in my previous work, I did that with personality traits. So I took things like extroversion, which are usually thought of as between-person constructs, in that people are either thought of as extroverted or introverted. Like people differ from that, but the way you are is the way you are is the way you are. And turned that into a within-person construct and looked at how people change and how extroverted or introverted they are from moment to moment, several times within the course of a day. We're doing the same kind of thing in this project with symptoms. Symptoms are typically seen as between-person constructs. You either have symptoms or you don't have them. What we're doing is saying, well, let's look at what happens within person as a person changes the times that they have symptoms versus the times that they don't have symptoms. When we do that, we take this occurrence of the symptom as a meaningful event. We take it seriously that when someone has the symptom, the moments that they have the symptoms, and as a window into understanding the disorder. Another unique feature of this project is we focus on experience and on BPD in its natural setting. Now, on the next slide, I'm going to just describe my four aims. They're going to seem somewhat abstract because there's a lot packed in here. Right now, I'm going to read them now, but I'm going to unpack them later as I go on. So the first aim is to obtain direct empirical accounts of BPD symptom frequencies, severities, and patterns of co-occurrence. The second aim is to propose and test several potential mechanisms for BPD. The third aim is to test the role of social perception processes in BPD's deleterious effect on interpersonal relationships. And the fourth aim is to chart trajectories of BPD symptom frequencies and severities and to test their person-environment transactions. So hopefully there's some glimmer of what that means, but it will become more clear as time goes on. So in the next slide, I talk about why we're doing this. There's several reasons why we're doing this project. The first reason is that it provides empirical firsthand knowledge of the symptoms people have. Most knowledge about symptoms is based on retrospections. People retrospecting in the clinical office on what happened last week or last year, or people retrospecting on questionnaires, describing how often they've experienced something in the last 6 months. But what we don't have is direct reports of how often and how severely people are actually experiencing these symptoms. And this is really important to diagnosing, is to know actual symptom frequencies and severities. It's important to the definition of the disorder, and it's important to clinical evaluation, being able to evaluate individuals in the clinic. Second reason we're doing this is that if there's a growing conviction amongst researchers of psychopathology that the key to borderline personality disorder lies in the regulation that people do of themselves and of their environment around the symptomatic responses to daily events. So how people react to events with their symptoms is, and the regulation around that is a key to BPD. Third reason we're doing this is that empirical tests of core features and underlying, that it provides empirical tests of core features and underlying etiology producing BPD and its symptoms. And when we can get these empirical tests of these causes, then we can improve development of effective treatments. And then finally, it's significant for the reason that you all know, is that this is a serious mental illness incurring considerable costs. Now, if you go to the next slide, I point out that there's been a lot of progress along this line of thinking in the last 5 years. So when we started writing this grant application, there's hardly anybody looking at symptoms and taking them seriously in this way. In the last 5 years, suddenly there's been an explosion of interest in doing it. So, for example, Kramer and others and Van Oost have conceptual models of diagnosis based entirely on symptom systems, how symptoms interact with each other. There's been a lot of work on contextual mechanisms underlying borderline personality disorder, such as Jolene Downey's work on rejection sensitivity. There's been work on the tracking of therapy progress with taking symptoms seriously and looking at them in real life. A lot of interesting work on the dynamics of emotions in daily life. So Tim Troll's work, I think he's talked about his work with you. There's been work on the interpersonal perceptions interactions. People like Pincus and Moskowitz have been doing that. And in fact, it seems to be an important part of the emerging assessment in DSM-5. So in the end, DSM-5 ended up being pretty much like DSM-4 for borderline personality disorder. But there's these alternative models suggested that may or may not be adapted at some point. One of them refers to this cross-cutting measure to measure all personality disorders. This measure, and other disorders as well, this measure is based on frequency and severity of symptoms in recent weeks. And then, of course, the focus on traits in the alternative personality disorder diagnostic system is entirely based on these kinds of ideas. So we think that this project is really poised to contribute to these ongoing debates about how to update DSM. All right, so now let me talk a little more concretely about the sample in the next slide. We had two sampling schemes, two separate ways of recruiting participants to the study. About two-thirds of them are what we call the high-end scheme. These are people that had to endorse 7 of 10 items referring to the 9 symptoms. This is based on Zanarini's McLean self-report measure. So they had to say that, yes, I have 7 of these 9 symptoms of borderline personality disorder to be eligible for the study. So this is people who are fairly symptomatic. And then that's about two-thirds of our subjects. The other third of our subjects came from what we call a spectrum sample. These are people who we recruited without regard for symptoms. Most of the high-end sample came from either newspaper ads saying, do you have symptoms like these symptoms of borderline personality disorder, or from outpatient psychiatric clinic in town. They went through a screen, which we'll talk about in a minute. We feel like the demographics are pretty good. We're particularly happy that we have a real nice racial mix, so we can look at some racial issues involved in borderline personality disorder. The mean age is 43 years. And so 84 of our roughly 300 participants meet criteria for BPD. So in a SCID, in a clinical interview, according to the SCID, they had 5 or more symptoms. So here's some more detail about the sample. We think that the sample includes a relatively severe end of borderline personality disorder. So, for example, go to the next slide called sample characteristics. So, I guess I didn't say that. That's the slide I'm looking at. We had over half the people have had psychotherapy in their lifetime, and almost half have had psychiatric medication at some point in their life. A quarter of them have been hospitalized in a psychiatric hospital during their life. So we feel like we've got a pretty high severe end of the disorder. Now, our strategy about comorbidity, we have a lot of comorbidity in our study, and our strategy on comorbidity was to not exclude people that are comorbid, but rather to include them and then statistically control for them for the comorbidity. And the reason for that is that so much of the comorbidity is due to actual features that are shared in common with the different disorders, and we felt that we'd be excluding part of the disorder of borderline personality disorder to be excluding people with these other disorders. So we started with 438 people that we screened, and then 311 of them were eligible and enrolled. 282 of them did complete the clinical interview that we have, and then 248 of them completed enough of the experience sampling reports to be analyzable. So more people completed some of the experience sampling. All the 282 of the people who did the clinical interview tried to do the experience sampling. Some didn't do that many of them. We had some exclusion criteria as well. Okay, so on the next slide, it just tells you about how many symptoms the people had that were in our study. And so zero symptoms means that they didn't have any of the symptoms. This is from the clinical interview. And so about 50 to 60 of the participants had, at least, they had, 50 to 60 of the 50 to 60 of the participants had no symptoms at all from that interview. But the rest of the participants had a variety of symptoms, from 1 up to 4 for people who were in our subclinical group level. And then a large number of them had, in fact, 84, as I mentioned before, had 5 or more symptoms. So you can see there's a widespread of levels of symptoms. Okay. The next slide begins to tell you a little bit about the method. The method sort of zooms in to studying the symptom in daily life. It starts by zooming right down into people's everyday lives, and that's represented by this green semicircle in the middle of this diagram. So what we did is we give people Palm Pilots or iPods, and 5 times a day, they told us how much they've been experiencing that symptom in the last 60 minutes. So they did it 5 times a day for 2 weeks. So in the past 60 minutes, how much have you been fearing abandonment or having suicidal thoughts and went through all the rest of the symptoms? We also asked them about the triggers that they were experiencing at that moment, the environmental events, things like how much were people betraying you in the last 60 minutes. So asked about their emotions as well. They also did that at the end of every day. Then what I hear it say that ear hears is that then one of these days, about a third of our participants also wore a tape recorder for the entire day that could record what was going on around them. It only recorded snippets. It didn't record the whole day. It just recorded snippets across that day. So we get another perspective on what was happening in that individual's life. Now zooming out from that, intense focus on the moment, we have what we call temporal layering. And what we did is we asked at multiple time frames for people to report on the symptoms that they were having. So we also asked them at the end of each week, how much during this week did you have these symptoms? At the end of each day, month, how much during that month? We asked for 6 months, how did you have the symptoms? Then we asked them at the end of those 6 months, during that 6 months, how much did you have those symptoms? And then annually was actually at the end of 18 months, how much did you have those symptoms? So what we have here is that we can catch symptoms that are rare, but also we can get different perspectives. And it's quite possible that, when someone reflects on their day, they may give different answers to these questions than when they're in the throe of it. And it's not clear in the throe of it. It's not clear which direction those differences would go. Now, in addition to that, that's the green part of the diagram there. If you go down in the orange part of the diagram, what we have is what are called the informant ratings or the study partner ratings. Every participant picked someone to be their study partner, and this person also filled out reports about the symptoms that the participant was having, not what the study partner was having, but what the participant was having. They didn't do it during the 5 times a day, but they did it at the end of every week, at the end of every month, at the end of every 6 months, and at the end of every 18 months. So they also gave us reports on the symptoms that the participant was having. Now, if you go to the next slide, you see that although the study is very intensive and really studies in detail what's going on in people's lives, it's also very expensive. and longitudinal going across time. So if you look at the very first part on the left, you see we start with a clinical interview, and then we go through several questionnaires, questionnaires about their past life events, about their personality, about the quality of their life. Then do that layering, that temporal and interpersonal layering and experience sampling that I just told you about. And then finally, do an exit interview. Then we wait for 18 months of life events to go by and repeat the whole thing again. If you press your, if you're, I don't know, if some of you are just looking at the slides, this, you know, this blue line will already be there, but for the rest of you, if you press the space bar, the blue line will show up, which is where we are right now. So where we are right now is over halfway through with the second wave of collecting this data. So at the end of the second wave, we'll be able to look at some causal effects of those life events on changes in borderline personality disorder. Then when we're done with that, we're going to let 18 months of life events pass and start it all over again. And actually, we're not letting the time pass because the third wave, when we start the third wave, it'll be immediately after the second wave ends, we'll be starting with the people who did the second wave at the very beginning. Okay, the next slide, I'm going to now delve into the specific aims in a little more detail, starting with aim one, which again, I'll remind you, is to obtain direct empirical accounts of borderline personality disorder symptom frequencies, their severities, and the patterns of co-occurrence. And like I said, we use experience sampling methodology where people carry Palm Pilots around with them and 5 times a day for 2 weeks describe the symptoms they're experiencing, so on. Now, we think that it's important to do this because getting, you know, sort of norm information about how often people are experiencing symptoms should be able to improve judgments of diagnosis, of the treatment efficacy, and treatment continuation. What clinicians have to do, and they get really good at this over, with experience, but what they have to do is they have to sort of, you know, figure out how often this particular individual in front of them is actually experiencing the symptoms from these retrospective reports, and then compare it to their lore of how often people in general experiencing these symptom reports. These symptoms, based on, I guess, on the other participants that, or the other clients that they've had over the years. But that's, it would be more useful to have some concrete knowledge that they could compare it to. It also establishes benchmarks for defining categories of symptom sufferers. So if we can find that there are clear differences in groups of how often people are experiencing symptoms, we can start to then use those as benchmarks for defining the groups of severity of borderline personality disorder, which also is related to this allows us to test whether we should consider it as a discrete or a continuous disorder. We can also look at patterns of symptom co-occurrence to look at the definition, and we can also use this to expand treatment tools. I am kind of excited about the idea that this is the kind of thing you could do at the beginning or in the middle or at the end or throughout treatment. Say, for example, when the client first comes, you could give them a Palm Pilot, have them report 5 times a day on their symptoms, their stressor events that they experienced during those 2 weeks. Have a computer program that analyzes that data real quick and prints it out in the clinical office, and they can discuss with the clinician can discuss with the client sort of the patterns of the symptoms, the frequency of the symptoms, and the timing of the symptoms, and what kind of events they seem to be reactions to. I think this is a very exciting idea. It's actually pretty similar to what Linehan already talked about in DBT is one of the techniques she uses, but not with the Palm Pilots or the iPods or the computer analyses. All right, there's been, on the next slide, I describe some of the recent work that people have done looking at these experience sampling type reports of borderline personality disorder. So, for example, Tim Troll has shown that emotions are, in fact, more variable for people who have borderline personality disorder than those who don't. Pincus and Moskowitz have looked at how interpersonal interactions and perceptions are related to each other. Other people have looked at it with other disorders, have looked at the symptoms of other disorders. And now, getting away from experience sampling, but just this general issue of dichotomous nature of borderline personality disorder, there's been 3 taxonomic studies, and it's not enough to be definitive yet, but it looks like borderline personality disorder is dimensional rather than categorical, so that you can have degrees of borderline personality disorder. There's also been some work on whether there are 1, 3, or 5 factors of symptoms in borderline personality disorder. Namely, so can we think of it just as one symptom, or are there really three distinct types of symptoms, or even five distinct types of symptoms? So now I'm going to finally mention some of our preliminary findings. What this graph shows on the next slide is reports, the frequency of reports of fear of abandonment. So we took the symptom of fear of abandonment, and simply, so people, the rating scale when they were asked this question five times a day was, went from 1 to 6, with 1 being that the symptom was not at all descriptive of what they were doing in the last 60 minutes, and 6 meant that it was very descriptive of what they were doing in the last 60 minutes. And what we're finding here is the dominant rating was not at all. That of the 9 to 10,000 reports that people provided during those 2 weeks, over 8,000 of them were, I'm not experiencing this symptom at all. Very few reports showed higher levels of symptomatic of that symptom of fear of abandonment. So, you know, if the symptoms are really so uncommon in everyday normal functioning, it suggests that, you know, the expression of borderline personality disorder in these symptoms is qualitatively different from normal functioning. The normal function does not involve fear of abandonment. So expressing fear of abandonment is qualitatively different, suggesting that there's sort of a discontinuity between borderline personality disorder and other functioning. You know, in the midst of borderline personality disorder as a sufferer or family member, it sometimes is a bit surprising to discover that most people don't experience any symptoms at all in the course of 2 weeks. It's also the case that people that are high in borderline personality disorder, so the greener portion of these bars was the 84 people who were diagnosed with borderline personality disorder according to our clinical interview, the vast majority of them, their reports were also no symptom at all. So this idea that, you know, symptoms are pervasive or inflexible is not borne out by the frequency with which people are experiencing them. Most people are, including those with borderline personality disorder, are not experiencing fear of abandonment at all most of the time. And this is a challenge for continuity. It's also a challenge for the descriptions of borderline personality disorder as pervasive and inflexible. You go to the next slide with the same kind of data but depicted in a different way. In this slide, so what we did is we calculated for each person the average level of their borderline personality disorder. I'm sorry, the average level of their fear of abandonment across the 2 weeks. So, in an average, for example, I'll start with the blue bars. This very long, tall bar represents about 140 people that had an average of around 0 or maybe negligibly above 0 for their level of fear of abandonment across the 2 weeks. So that means at any given moment, they're going to have no fear of abandonment. If a person's average goes up, if their average is a little bit higher, so the next bar to the right is people who have an average around 0.25 to 0.5, that means that their average level, the typical amount that they're experiencing fear of abandonment any given moment, is, you know, a quarter of a point. So very little. And what you see here is the same kind of data, that people's average level of borderline fear of abandonment is really small. The vast majority of people have almost no, you know, basically none or negligible amount of fear of abandonment over the course of 2 weeks. The next three bars we're using, the bars in blue are the people who were below threshold for borderline personality disorder. They had 0 to 4 symptoms. The next three bars from 0.25 to 1.0 are people who have averages that are, you know, less than 1 at any given moment. So that's their average experience of the fear of abandonment. Another way to conceive of that is these are people who have more than one experience of fear of abandonment in the course of a week, but not as much as once a day. So they have, you know, some experiences of it, comes up once a week, but it doesn't happen every day. Once you get to that one line, at that point is where you have people who are experiencing the symptom of fear of abandonment at least once a day. And what you see here is this blue sample, those people that are below criterion, almost nobody is above 1. Almost nobody is experiencing this symptom once a day. You have a small group of people that are experiencing it between once a week and once a day. And then the vast majority of people are never experiencing it at all. If you go to the right side of this graph, this is where the green bars are. These are people who met thresholds, so they had five or more symptoms of borderline personality disorder in the clinical interview. And what you see for them is that the largest bar for them is no or negligible experience of fear of abandonment during a two-week period. So they also are not experiencing the symptom very often at all. Again, the next group, like for the blue bars, is this group of people that have it about once, more than once a week, but not once a day. And then there's this very small number of people who have the symptom more than once a day. But no one is really that high. Very few people are over 3, for example, in the average level that they're experiencing the fear of abandonment. So again, this says that, you know, people are not experiencing this symptom very often at all, even those with borderline personality disorder. And that's a challenge for trying to explain borderline personality disorder as connected to normal personality. It also suggests that maybe there you could look at this as having 3 groups of symptom experiences. For any given symptom, you could say that there are 3 groups. There's the group that doesn't have that symptom at all, the group that has it once a week, but not as much as once a day, and then a third group who has it more than once a day. The first group would be asymptomatic. The second group we would call proto-symptomatic, and these are people that might benefit from some consultation with a clinician to talk about the meaning of that symptom. And then the third group is people who we would call symptomatic. Okay, I'm going to go now to the second aim. The second aim is to propose and test several potential mechanisms for borderline personality disorder. Our model of borderline personality disorder zooms in to this very simple concept we call the core contingency principle. And what we believe is going on in the core contingency principle is that there's a stressor, something in the environment that is a stress that causes a symptom. It's very simple. That's how symptoms occur for borderline personality disorder in this model. So, for example, there might be the event or the stressor of being betrayed, and this would lead to the symptom of a fear of abandonment. And that's the core contingency. It's a contingency of the symptoms on the existence of the stressors. So that's the basic, simple model that we're trying to test. Now, the reason we're doing this, on the net, as it's described in the next slide, is that there's a rich literature of potential mechanisms, but they haven't been combined together. What we can do is combine these models together and test them all together at once. Secondly, we believe that these mechanisms should be tested in people's actual lives, that they're actually living their lives, how the stressors are affecting their symptoms, which we can test with experience sampling. And then this model, what it does, is, and I'll show you in a couple slides, it allows us to distinguish between these stressor contingency causes and predisposing factors and sustaining causes. And on the next slide, I just mention again that there's a growing conviction that the key to borderline personality disorder lies in the regulation around these symptomatic responses to daily events. So how people regulate themselves in response to these events and in response to their symptoms. And for example, Geraldine Downey's work on rejection and abandonment, Linehan and Zanarini's work on interpersonal offense, betrayal, boredom, negative mood, Bednar and Skodal's work on disappointment and neglect, Adler and Wester's work on isolation and loneliness, and also Bender and Skull's work on identity threat. These are all types of stressors that lead to symptoms. So that very simple model of the core contingency expands up into a fairly complex overall model that is depicted in the next slide of borderline personality disorder. So it becomes this very big, complex model because in those following ways. So first, if you look at the side on the right where the gray bars are, the gray shading is, so there are 3 boxes there, but actually all 3 of those boxes are just different categorizations of the symptoms. So they're all the symptoms. So we have the cognitive symptoms, the affective symptoms, and the social and behavioral symptoms. On the left lower side, there's 2 boxes there, but they're actually just the stressors or the environmental events. So really, this model mostly is, and if you press your space bar again, you'll see the blue dotted circle. Most of this model is just the core contingency, where you have one of the two boxes on the left is a stressor causing one of the symptoms on the right. Then this box, this model adds another box in the upper left, which is the predisposing factors and sustaining causes. And this is where we bring in things like childhood abuse, hyperbolic temperament, rejection sensitivity, life events like divorce or job loss as having an impact on borderline personality disorder. And what this what these events do is they can affect three things. They can affect the frequency with which the stressors occur, they can affect the frequency with which the symptoms occur, but most interestingly, they can affect the reaction of people with their symptoms to those stressors, so they can enhance those reactions or diminish those reactions. But before I go any further, I'm going to pause. Any questions yet? Dr. Billing?
No, you're fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll keep going then. All right, so I'm going to give you some preliminary data on testing this model with just one symptom and one stressor. And the next slide shows that. And then if you press your spacebar again, what first appears is just the core contingency with betrayal, an arrow connecting it to fear of abandonment and fear of abandonment. And what we did is we simply looked at whether fear of abandonment was associated with being betrayed. And we found it was significantly associated. Now, what's different about this is not a questionnaire where people asked, were they betrayed in the past and do they feel a fear of abandonment, but rather it looks at the timing that these events are occurring. So what we're finding is the fear of abandonment symptoms that are rarely occurring, when they are occurring, is the times that the person's been betrayed. And they're not occurring when the person is not betrayed. So that's what this shows, that the fear of abandonment is timed precisely to being betrayed. Now, if you press the space bar again, what will show up in the upper right is a histogram graph. What's really neat about this methodology is that because each person gives us 50 reports, they do 5 times a day for 2 weeks, each person is like a study unto him or herself, a study completely all by him or herself. They give as much data as a normal study would give with 50 different people. Each subject or each participant gives themselves. And so what we can do is we can get principles or laws that apply to just that person by analyzing that person separately and alone. And then we can look at all the different people, all the different principles and laws that apply to all the different people. So what I showed you about that 0.14 that I showed you relating betrayal to fear of abandonment, that's the average across people. But what this histogram shows is that people actually had different relationships between being betrayed and fearing abandonment. So most of the people are right there around slightly positive, around 0.14. That's why that bar in the middle is the highest. But other people, as you go to the right, have much stronger reactions to betrayal with fear of abandonment. They become much more frightened of abandonment when they're betrayed, all the way up to someone had a 2 reaction. You also go the other way, you find that some people had negative reactions in terms of fear of abandonment to betrayal. So some people actually became less frightened of abandonment when they were betrayed. So each person has their own different principle or law that describes their reactions to these triggers. Now, if you press the space bar again, what will show up is a box representing borderline personality disorder with an arrow pointing to the first arrow. What that arrow means, and that was significant statistically, what that arrow shows us is that the reaction of those with borderline personality disorder to betrayal was 50% stronger than those without borderline personality disorder. So they have a 50% stronger, more intense fear of abandonment reaction to betrayal than those without borderline personality disorder. The average person that doesn't have borderline personality disorder does react to betrayal with fear of abandonment. That's the typical way people are reacting. But with borderline personality disorder, that reaction is intensified quite a bit. And finally, if you press the space bar again, the next two arrows that show up are one leading from borderline personality disorder directly down to betrayal. It's a strong relationship. So people with borderline personality disorder were betrayed more often than those without, according to their own reports. And the final arrow is the direct arrow from borderline personality to fear of abandonment, which says that those with borderline personality disorder also feared abandonment more than those without it, regardless of being betrayed or not being betrayed. We can't wait till we can get into looking at the other symptoms, looking at all the different triggers and all the predisposing factors and the changes over time in these processes. It's only preliminary data so far. Okay, next slide, AIM 3. The next aim is to test the role of social perception processes in borderline personality disorder's deleterious effect on interpersonal relationships. There's various reasons we're doing this, as are described in the next slide. First of all, by getting other people's perceptions, we can validate these self-reports of symptoms and triggers. By getting reciprocal perceptions of people, the study partner and the participant have reciprocal perceptions of each other. By getting those reciprocal perceptions, we can look at the role of them in the interpersonal conflicts that might happen. And we can directly examine the positivity of perceptions of others that people have, including those with borderline personality disorder. So the next slide, I'll show you some preliminary data. What this is ratings by our participants of their study partner. Now, these study partners were spouses, significant others, other family members, friends, so people that they were that knew them relatively well. And we asked them to rate their study partner on standard personality dimensions, a standard personality questionnaire, 100 questions. And what this graph shows is that there are no differences between those with BPD and those without in their perceptions of the personality of their study partners. That means that, for example, with extroversion, people with BPD thought that their study partners had an extroversion level just over 3, and those that didn't have BPD thought that their study partners had an extroversion level just over 3, just about the same. There's slight differences in the bars, but none of those were significant. The only one that was significant was altruism, which there was a slight significance there. So, you know, normally I'm loath to present null findings, and just find that, you know, because people don't find them as interesting. But this one I might be pretty interesting, because what it says is that, you know, this myth that people with borderline are, you know, particularly negative about their close others in their lives doesn't support it at all here. So I thought that was pretty important and interesting. And I thought, well, I wonder if that's, you know, maybe they didn't understand the scale, or maybe they, you know, just were nice about things. So on the next slide, I show their ratings of themselves. This is everybody's ratings of themselves on the personality dimensions. And here what we see is that people with borderline personality disorder were quite negative about themselves. Every single one of these, except for intellect, they were significantly lower in their self-ratings than people that didn't have BPD were. So people with BPD think that they're introverted. They think that they're disagreeable. They think that they're irresponsible. They think that they're overly emotional. They don't have any differences in intellect. They think they're dishonest, and they think that they're not as altruistic as other people think about themselves. So they're willing to be negative. They're willing to say things that are negative and unpleasant, but they don't say them about their study partner. So it's not that they aren't willing to say negative things or they don't understand the scales. They clearly did. It's just that when people sit back and reflect with those with BPD, you get honest, truthful answers about their opinions of other people. So many questions about this. I'm sure people have lots of questions about this. You know, and we can't wait to analyze what the study partners' perceptions were of themselves and of the participants, the changes in these perceptions, the relationships to ear recordings, the connections between these perceptions and symptoms, and so on. But right now, we only have preliminary data. So now I'm going to go on to AIM 4.
Well, I have an email here.
Okay.
It says, can't wait, can't wait, can't wait, can't wait.
That's the way I feel.
Fascinating. No, another one. Fascinating. This is terrific. You've wowed the people already.
Well, thank you very much. That's very encouraging. I'm very happy to hear that. Let me continue. So AIM 4 is to chart trajectories of borderline personality disorder symptom frequencies and severities and to test their person-environment transactions. So what the left little figure shows here is the sort of the vicious cycle, where BPD symptoms lead to more life stressors, which then lead to more symptoms, and so on. So that's the negative cycle. The right side is the virtuous counterpart. It's quite possible that having improvement in borderline personality disorder would lead to life successes, and then those life successes would lead to further improvements and so on. So we could possibly see both sides of it. And if you press the space bar, you'll see a dotted line. That's where we are right now. Unfortunately, we're just measuring people's response, the life stressors that they've had, so we can't look at the transactional process yet. We can only look at the current state of what their lives are like. We think this is really important, first of all, to follow up the exciting findings of remission that Zanarini's found, to compare symptoms on the rates of remission. It may be that some symptoms remit more quickly than others. And then also to look at the role of major life events in, you know, sustaining or ameliorating these symptoms. So here's some preliminary findings about the quality of life. What we did here is we just simply asked people to rate the overall quality of their life as a whole and then also in several domains. And we always use the same kind of scale that was like, it was, we call the worst possible to best possible scale. So for example, the first one is your overall life. We asked people, imagine the worst life possible that you could. That's a zero. Now imagine the best possible life you could imagine. That's a 10. And what we want you to do is rate where your life is in between those two extremes. And the first bar, the blue bars, are the bars for people who did not meet criterion for borderline personality disorder, who had no symptoms of borderline personality disorder. And what you see is that their average is about 7.5, which is typical in other studies. So quite good. Their lives are quite good. You know, much closer to best possible than the worst possible, and quite a bit up there. What you see, unfortunately, is the sad news is that for people with a BPD diagnosis, their life quality is substantial. And so, for example, it's at a 4 on overall life quality. Much closer to worst possible than to best possible, and much closer to worst possible than it is for people who don't have borderline personality disorder. And unfortunately, this is true for every domain. So it was true for their health, it was true for their work, it was true for their finances, it was true for their religious dimension in their lives, it was true for their social network. If you pop ahead to the next slide, it was true in their relationship with their children, it was true in their social network, and it was true in their marital or close relationship. So that's the sad news. Going back to the first slide, the point of this is advocacy. And you already know this, but I think it bears repeating as much as possible. Hello, I just heard some beeps. Am I still going? Everything still good?
Yep.
Yep, okay. So it bears repeating as much as possible that this is a very debilitating disorder. It has severe negative consequences for people's lives, and it deserves to be a national priority because of the across-the-board
Hello, I think we lost Will.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. I thought it was my phone. Why don't we wait a second and see if he dials in again?
Hi, Terry.
Yes, Trish. Okay, good. Trish is there, Jim.
Yes.
We lost the presenter, Trish, so we're just waiting.
Yeah, I gathered that, yeah. I am going to dial in again.
He probably doesn't realize we've lost him.
I'm sending him an email right now.
Oh, good, Jeff. Okay.
For work.
Hey, Perry?
Yes.
This is really fascinating.
It's wonderful, yes.
Oh, wait, it's...
Harry, can you hear me?
Yes. We have a lot of people on mute. Jim, would you like me to unmute people and see if they have any questions they'd like to ask?
Yeah, I sent Will Thiessen a note, but he may not. He's probably turning away.
Well, exactly. He's probably not on his computer. So all of you who are on the call, we're going to unmute you, and feel free if you'd like to ask some questions, although our presenter's not on, but maybe he will come back. Okay, I'm starting to unmute people. Okay, can somebody respond who wasn't on mute before so we know that worked?
It worked.
Oh, good. Thank you so much. Does anybody have any questions or thoughts for questions that we can present when Will gets back on? You know what I can do? Let me just try to see if I can find his number. Do you have his number, Jim?
I don't. I don't know whether he's at home or is at the office.
What would his zip his area code be?
Hi, phone died. Be right back.
Oh, good. He knows where's good. So he realized.
Yeah, that can happen. My wireless here goes. I have to watch it because at the end of the hour it can go dead.
Right. I'll put everyone back on mute then.
Harry?
Trish, how do you want to be introduced? I can just say, I would prefer that people introduce themselves. It's one thing to go to a Family Connections meeting where everybody there is going to be, you know, have a borderline member, and it's kind of a closed group, but this, you know, things are forever alive on the Internet, so I don't know if you want to use just your name or say Reviewer C or a parent or what. It's up to you.
Oh, as parent.
Okay, we'll just introduce you as a parent.
Or family, you know, parent, family member, whatever. I don't mind. Also as an educator, I guess.
All right, I'm back.
Welcome back.
Yeah, very sorry. I apologize greatly for that. Let me keep going and continue so I don't waste any more time here.
Okay.
So, so what we were saying was that the point is advocacy. As you all know, that this is a serious debilitating disorder, and it bears repeating as much as possible to demonstrating that, to show what the effects are on people's lives, to show that we should really make this a national priority. The other side, though, another point I want to make is about pervasiveness. So people aren't having the symptoms all the time, very rarely having the symptoms. So pervasiveness might really refer not to the frequency of having the symptoms, but rather the fact that it's across domains. Every domain of life seems to be affected by having borderline personality disorder. And so that's where maybe pervasiveness should be interpreted. And then the third point I want to make with these slides is the good news, the positive message that's in here, and that's the middle bars. The middle bars are people who have 1 to 4 symptoms of borderline personality disorder from our clinical interview. And what you see is that they're in between the people who had 0 symptoms and those who had 5 symptoms and the quality of every domain of life, including overall life, except for 1. So what that means is just the reduction in just a couple of symptoms is associated with significant enhancements in the improvement of quality of life. So that's the message of hope right there.
Hey, Will, there's a question that's come in.
Sure.
It concerns the controversy and views that borderline maybe isn't a real diagnosis, and it's, let's see if I get this right. Schizophrenia, we have people hallucinating and with delusions all the time, with cognitive impairment all the time, depressive people, depressed all the time. Mm-hmm. Borderline, here we've got fluctuations, so do we really have a real disorder, even though we have the impairment?
Yeah, that's a great question, a real interesting question. First of all, I think we need to test the assumption about other disorders, about how frequently people are having the symptoms. It may be the case that people are having depression all the time, but it may be the case that people with clinical levels of depression are not depressed all the time. I think there needs to be tests, schizophrenia as well. It may turn out with some of those disorders that it works that way. I'm not saying that it won't. I'm just saying that it needs to be tested. I think I was surprised to find how rare these symptoms are for borderline personality disorder. I found it quite surprising. Many of us are quite surprised by the rarity of those symptoms. So,
it is. It is very surprising.
Yeah, so given how surprising that is, we might be surprised with some other disorders as well. Secondly, I'm not sure why that's necessary for it to be real. I mean, what we have here is we have, in some ways, the fact that it's so rare to have these symptoms, so that the people who don't have borderline personality disorder essentially are almost never having them, suggests that any experience of a symptom puts you in a special category, in a different category. So any experience at all might be enough for it to be called to be qualified as a disorder, or at least to be enough to have further examination, say with a clinician. And that's where the cost-cutting measure of the if you look at where the severity measure in the proposed changes for DSM-5 or DSM-5.1 or whatever it's going to be, that the proposed changes for that are talking about any experience of symptoms is enough to qualify for some further examination with a clinician. So maybe that instead of requiring constant symptoms for a disorder, maybe any symptoms at all. Then when we look at the impairment, we look at the significant costs that it has in people's lives, I think to me that's a strong evidence that we can think of it as a disorder.
Yeah.
Okay, should I continue along?
Yeah, well, I think the thing is, if the symptoms are fluctuating, why do we have constant impairment and such pervasive impairment?
Yeah.
Does that maybe depend on the number of symptoms or the level of symptoms that people have? I mean, if you had 3 symptoms at a very high level, versus symptoms at an above average level over all 9,
yeah, so that's a great question. And that is one of the things we're going to look at is we're going to try to relate the number of symptoms that people are, the frequency that people are experiencing symptoms to the number of symptoms that they were diagnosed with in the interview. And it may very well be that there's a relationship there, that the more symptoms you have, the more frequently you'll be experiencing them in daily life.
Another, is it okay to ask a question here? Another question I had was, people are talking about remission. If you're looking like at the old DSM, the 9 symptoms, are some of them kind of more strategic in remission than others? Like if you have a remission in anger, does that happen more often than remission, say, in fear of abandonment?
Yeah, so that's a – go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
So that's a great question, and that is one of the things we're going to look at. We can't look at that until we've got people through 2 waves. Right? So we can't look at the frequency of, the rate of remission of these different symptoms until they get to people through 2 waves, and that's why we have 3 waves, is to look at whether different symptoms – I think that's a great question. So perhaps anger – remits more rapidly than fear of abandonment, or vice versa. And I think that would be important to look at as well.
Let me inject something here. The voice that you're hearing is one of our regular, has become a regular and very welcome reviewer commentator before the meeting. For if you look at your notes, it's reviewer C. And it's
okay.
Part of our effort. It's apparent, and it's part of our effort to involve people in the direct interaction. For folks, one of the things that just popped up is given the frequency of these interruptions of daily life for the participants to report their experience, doesn't that perhaps, but might that not alter somewhat the normal borderline experience?
I'm sorry, I lost you for a second. I didn't hear the given part.
Just given these interruptions 5 times a day. To report on these events and functionings, is this altering the experience, the borderline
right.
experience? Or is it a valid, accurate account? Do we have any data on that?
Yeah, well, we don't have that particular question. We can't address that particular question, and it's quite possible. I mean, there's been a long tradition of research called self-monitoring in the clinical tradition where, you know, monitoring one's behavior leads to improvements in that behavior.
Yep.
The effects of that have been relatively small. They're there, but they're relatively small, so it's possible that we're It's possible that people are experiencing some improvement for doing this for 2 weeks. It depends on people wanting to improve, which they may or may not want to in our study. But if they do want to, there may be some small improvement of that. We do know that people report at the end and during the exit interview that they often found it very interesting and they felt that they learned things about themselves during the study. They usually find it a little bit annoying to do it 5 times a day, but they also feel like they've learned a lot about themselves in the process. So there's that as well. We do have the informant reports, right, the study partner reports of the people's experiences. We also can look at, we have retrospective accounts of symptoms before the study, and we can compare those to the retrospective accounts after the study to see if there's been changes in those. So we can look at that a little bit. And then we are doing one. We're very close to one paper because we asked people 5 times a day, did you think about suicide in the last 60 minutes? We're asking that 5 times a day, and the research is pretty clear that that asking about suicide does not increase the likelihood of suicide. We were concerned that doing it 5 times a day might be different, so we only did that we asked those questions of half the participants. And our data there seems to suggest that it didn't have any effect. It had no effect on suicide attempts. There was no difference in our two groups, but there was. So the one group that we didn't ask the questions about suicide of had a decline in their suicidal thoughts during the first month of the study, and then it returned back to its baseline level for the remaining months of the study. And that decline didn't happen in the group that we asked questions about suicide. So it's possible that it prevented that not asking about suicide, but asking about other aspects of borderline personality disorder decreased the rate of suicidal thoughts, but that asking about all the symptoms, including suicide, didn't decrease the rate of suicidal thoughts. That's the closest I can get to you for the finding we have so far.
Thank you. Very interesting.
Yeah, could I just make a comment? Is it possible that, if you notice on TV that people are being interviewed, like if you think about how people used to react like 10, 15 years ago, people kind of muttered and stuttered, whereas now even, most people know how to be interviewed on TV, that with social media, that there will be a lesser effect on being asked questions because people are more used to being asked questions or knowing how to respond.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that's a very interesting idea. And, we're using Palm Pilots and iPods, so people, they're used to working with phones and things like that, so it's not going to seem unusual to, entering numbers into these little devices.
Mm-hmm,
but people
mm-hmm.
are used to that kind of thing as well, so it's quite possible that it wouldn't make as much a difference because people are used to it.
Well, when you're watching the airports, even 3-year-olds are running around with iPads, it's like a way of life.
That's right. Yes, my daughter is better at the iPad than I am, I think, my 3-year-old daughter. So, so that is a concern that they might affect them. I mean, that's one reason why we have the temporal layering, we have the interpersonal layering, we have the electronic recorder, we have the ear. So we have all these different ways of getting at the symptoms. We have the standard clinical interviews. We have all these different ways of getting at the symptoms people are experiencing to check to see if our method has changed something or is missing something or something like that. And, Dr. Breland, there's a great question you asked about why is even one or two symptoms, if they're not experiencing them very often, why is it causing such a decrement in their life quality? I think we can actually get at that. So that's a great question. It was not a question that we had planned to address, but I think we can look at these symptoms individually and their effects on life events that happen in between the two waves and then try to get a handle on how it is that having a symptom once a day is enough to, or even once a week is enough to, you know, make a significant decrement in one's, you know, quality of one's work or relationship.
Dr. Thiessen, you know, I think you can tell by my accent that, you know, I kind of originated from England. So I have to use a very English phrase that is being gobsmacked, is that, you know, which means that you are utterly amazed at something. And just like during, I'm not very medical, but during the reading, I'm reading a couple of your articles and the extent of the work that you're doing, it was just like really amazing. Like, how, you know, kind of you manage to get all of this to manageable proportions. Like when you look at the IPIP, the number of, you know, descriptors we have for emotions and but how well you have described this to us, I mean, it just really is incredible. It's also very hopeful, you know. I just have one question. When you look at the mean age of people in the sample is 43, I think.
Mm-hmm.
How does the, I mean, you hear that people kind of mellow out with BPD, you know, mm-hmm. in their 40s. What kind of age range did you have in this, or do you have?
Yeah, so, well, first of all, thank you very much. I mean, that really means a lot. I have to admit, I was pretty nervous about this, presenting this to this particular audience.
I don't know how you got into 5 minutes, you know. It's like, wow.
Sorry?
I said it's incredible to try and even begin to describe what you're doing in 45 minutes.
Well, yeah, that was one reason. But the other reason is this is an audience, a wide-ranging audience of people who have experience. Some people have experiences of different kinds. And so to hear from you that you think this is really valuable and worthwhile is really gratifying and meaningful to me. So thank you very much. And in terms of the question about how did we do this, great team. I just want to say we have a really great team that works extremely hard. And then your third question was, I'm sorry, I'm
about
a little
the
bit,
age, the mean age, and
oh,
about
yeah.
the age range that you have.
Yeah, so we have between, I know the youngest person is 18,
mm-hmm.
and then the oldest person is in their 60s, I think, but I don't have more concrete information about the age range. I know it's a wide range of ages, mm-hmm. It comes up. I mean, it does seem to matter in incidents. So it does look like it's going to be a meaningful variable to examine in our data.
Hmm.
Okay. Well, I just want to finish up by saying that, you know, the point of this is to take symptoms seriously, that, you know, and I hope that I've shown that taking symptoms seriously is going to lead to new insights about the definition, the mechanism, and the treatment of borderline personality disorder. And I also want to mention that the last 2 years I've seen others realizing the importance of taking symptoms seriously. And I think only by doing this, and I think other scientists are agreeing with this too, is that are we going to be able to improve the lives of those with BDD? So you know, I'm hopeful that we will be able to contribute to that somehow. So I guess I'm open to questions if there's, depending on the time, what time is left.
Yeah, we have gone till 9 after, and the key thing that, two things that bubble up, well, three things that I have a bunch of notes here, but one is people would, and you need to respond now, I don't want to put you on the spot, but they have multiple requests to have an opportunity for some larger discussion with you about these results.
No.
People are really fascinated by it.
Wonderful.
Secondly, they're wondering about when the final results on a larger scale will be available and how this diverse audience, which generally is not tied into research journals, can access it.
Yep.
They do look at some.
So first of all, we have papers underway, so the results are going to start being submitted to journals in the next weeks. We have the whole Excel chart of all the papers that we're working on, who's doing them, and when they're going to be out, and the few papers will be out in a matter of weeks. We'll be submitted to journals. So our main plan right now is to get the data into the findings into journals, scientific journals. you know, the, I think that's a great question about how to disseminate it to a broader audience. I'm certainly open to, you know, further discussions. I don't have a lot on my webpage because I don't want to stigmatize people in the study, and I also don't want to give away too much of the hypotheses before the participants have completed the results. So my webpage is actually pretty sparse about this. The but after the results start coming out, that might change. But I would like to hear, I mean, suggestions from listeners on what would be good ideas to do.
Okay, we might, given the time, but I think we'll pursue that and get back to you about that.
Okay.
Because people are interested and they really enjoy the opportunity to interact in this interplay. It's just terrific. The question is, there's a real concern. There's so few researchers in borderline, and a number of the senior people are retiring. And it's tough then for junior people because they don't have mentors to help with larger grants in which they can do some work to help launch their own career thing. So they wonder about with the Templeton thing. You know, what in your mind, and you may want to think about this, respond later, for topics to pursue and what would, for senior investigators, and we might particularly interested people to bring into the field like you and Geraldine Downey, who has contributed so much. Her social rejection sensitivity was just probably the top-rated topic in terms of interest this whole year.
Yeah,
and they're wondering about with beginning investigators if there was $1 million, or and we do have Families for Borderline Research that are raising funds to be given through the Brain and Behavior Research Institute, NARSED now, grants. And there's first two started on those, so there's way, but, you know, we've got to get more people in this, and the question is, what would be some good topics?
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, on the Templeton grant, where what we did is we got money from Templeton and then turned around and gave it out to junior, quite new researchers to study moral character. And I was a little trepidatious about the amount of work that would be, but it turned out to be one of the most rewarding things I've done, and watching these young people, you know, devote their careers now to that issue. So I think it's a great mechanism, you know, to have a senior person maybe oversee, you know, come up with some topics that would be, you know, ways to attract young people into the field and give them small grants to do stuff on, and I think that's a wonderful idea. And what kinds of topics? I mean, I think there's a wide range of topics that would attract a lot of interest. I mean, I think personality as a field, you know, is a, just not as psychopathology, but personality as a field is so closely connected to psychopathology that there's really a lot of potential for taking, you know, attracting researchers that are in, you know, studying normal personality to get them more interested in psychopathology.
Yeah. The other thing that's kind of boiled in here is we had Leanna Clark present it and also Lynn on her approach to assessing personality disorder, namely to assess for the personality traits and then look for significant impairment that you would not otherwise explain. And Lynn Sims, one of her students who has a major grant for some related work, and he's using item response theory and computer adaptive testing to come up with very relatively fast and efficient way of assessing the personality. But that's kind of looking for stability, and your model is really saying, at least on the symptom level, that that stability may not be there.
Right.
So people are really wondering, where do we go for our diagnostic scheme with DSM?
Yeah, so what I think that what we have to look for stability is not constantly having the symptoms, but rather people's average levels of the symptoms. So even though, you know, a person with borderline personality disorder might only have, you know, fear of abandonment once a week or maybe once every other day, that once every other day is going to continue for week after week after week. So where you're going to see the stability is in these averages across the variability. And so what this model does is it it mixes together both the variability and the stability to see both of them happening in the disorder.
And a person's reaction to that feeling too, how they will play it out.
Yes.
You know, if you have someone who has, a fear of abandonment and you have a very marked reaction to that, then, you know, it's like the ripples on the pond.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly right. You said that perfectly right. Well, and the other place the stability comes in is in that reaction. So even though you're not experiencing it very often, you have that, you're going to always have that intense reaction to that event happening. And then it's going to, and then that's going to ripple into other symptoms that are going to have other consequences and so on. And that's why all those arrows were in that big model. All of those arrows are about symptoms feeding into each other and then feeding back into the stressors and so on and creating this, you know, once one happens, it does create a lot of ripples.
We're really imposing on you. We're 16 after, so I need to conclude it, and I know I'm going to jar some people here because we've got such interest, but just to let you know that we have a very panting, eager audience that really wants to engage on you and very excited about these results. You really had an impact. I think Geraldine and you have been probably the big stirrers of high interest here.
Well, that's really something. I'm going to have trouble going to bed tonight, I think.
and engagement, and thank you, everybody. And remind you that August 4 will be our next session with Patrick Henry, and if you want to join our reviewer 3 and parent that you heard today, when the slides for Patrick Henry's talk become available, it will be on mental health parity, to send your comments in and questions, and we will try to have 2 or 3 people to have be involved in that live interaction. So thank you all for joining us, and thank you particularly, Will, for giving up your Sunday evening and all your considerable preparation, very thoughtful and careful preparation for this talk. We really appreciate it.
Thank you again for having me, and thanks so much for the very thoughtful questions and thoughts and all the ones that I got emailed ahead of time and all the work that you're doing. So thanks very much.
So much.
Okay. Goodbye, everybody. Everybody have a great evening and terrific week. Stay cool. Enjoy the summer and dial in on August 4th.
Take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.